This podcast is for personal consumption only and may not be proliferated or reproduced in any way without the explicit permission of its author.
This paper aims to contribute to interdisciplinary reflection on decolonization by introducing two categories that I believe specifically characterize settler colonial forms: isopolity and deep colonizing. It focuses on debates concerning the settler polities of the British Empire during the second half of the 19th century. These polities achieved independent status in the context of metropole-assisted processes envisaging ultimate substantive devolution as an enhancement of political ties rather than their discontinuation. While these drawn-out constitutional processes have been the subject of extensive comparative scrutiny, the isopolitical nature of the imagination that underpinned them has remained unexplored. An isopolity can be described as a single political community joining separate jurisdictions. It's a form that is typical of the classical world, and more recently, the debates about isopolity have sort of informed discussions about the Union of Germany during the 19th century. The independence of the other Englands, as Freud described them in 1886 in Oceania, was to constitute a British Empire of racial identity, as Charles Wentworth Dilke put in 1919 Greater Britain. This empire was then imagined as a dialectical counterpoint to the political subordination of a racialized colonial world, a subordination that was projected indefinitely onto the future. Appraising isopolitical relationships, I argue, can contribute to an understanding of independence and decolonization that goes beyond familiar narratives emphasizing anti-colonial militancy, metropolitan concessions, and nationalist takeovers in the context of a non-sovereign to sovereign and or colonial dependency to independent polity paradigm. However, as the independence of these polities was crucially premised on an ultimate settler assumption of responsibility for the indigenous peoples contained within the area they exclusively claimed, a study of their decolonization provides another point of departure for complicating available narratives of decolonization, as it removed the possibility of appeal to the metropolitan sovereign against settler abuse, and as it removed imperial oversight, this polity's independent status was actually premised on the enhanced subjection of indigenous others. Paradoxically, then, settler independence constitutes an acceleration, not a discontinuation of colonial practices. I define this circumstance as deep colonizing, a situation in which the very institutions that should operate towards its supersession actually entrench colonialism's operative registers. The first section of this paper focuses on isopolitical relations as an alternative possibility besides sustained colonial domination on the one hand and internationally recognized independence within an international system of formally independent polities on the other. Its second section concentrates on deep colonizing, a notion that upsets traditional amelioristic narratives emphasizing progressive processes culminating in the acquisition of social and political rights for colonized and formerly colonized peoples. Appraising concomitantly an isopolitical imaginary and deep colonizing, and more generally focusing on decolonization processes in settler colonial settings, can help reframing received narratives of decolonization. My argument, in short, is that independence and decolonization should be considered as, at times, antithetical dynamics. The classical world and its political categories. The classical world had an articulated institutional imagination. There were isopolitical ties between polities. There were sympolities. There were symmachias. I want to stop here and sort of unpack these three concepts. An isopolity... I mean, I know it's hot stuff, but... An isopolity is a circumstance in which people can seamlessly travel and acquire immediate political rights when they move across jurisdictions. So this is obviously relevant for an understanding of settler colonialism, because settlers travel with the sovereign charge on their backs. They travel and immediately acquire a sovereign determination wherever they get to. And in this sense, a settler is most definitely not a migrant. A migrant is an appellant that's facing a political order that is already constituted. But in an isopolitical system, this person is traveling with rights that sort of travel with him. So this is an isopolity. A sympolity is simply a situation in which one polity rules over another. They remain separate, but the emanating sort of sovereign sort of is concentrated in one locale rather than another. A symmachia is a warring league. It's a situation in which two polities remain distinct, but they are automatically engaged in warfare should the other one become embroiled in war. So, for example, when Australia joined the First Gulf War without even requiring Parliament to discuss it, this was a classic case of a modern-day symmachia, where you know it is automatic participation in war in the war effort as part of the League. So all of these categories are kind of relevant because, well, I hope the reason why we can sort of clear in the end. But I just wanted to explain what is an isopolity and how it is relevant to an understanding of settler colonialism. Different and now this is the first part of my paper, settler colonialism and isopolitical relations. Different colonial forms produce the different circumstances of their supersession. If colonialism and settler colonialism remain structurally different formations, a point that I have argued elsewhere as well, then decolonization needs to be framed separately. Thus, to move beyond settler colonialism and to imagine its decolonization, we need to understand how it works. The question of how British settler nationalisms and metropolitan imperialisms have codified each other while operating concomitantly and in reciprocal tension is the subject of an extensive scholarly literature and an issue that is periodically approached and yet rarely resolved. Settler nationalisms remain intractably ambivalent. Settler claims are routinely premised on their arising immediately from the settler locale and simultaneously from the originating metropole. For example, reflecting on the relationship between Australian nationalism and Britishness, Neville Meaney concluded in 2001 that, and I'm quoting, "It would not then be unfair to draw the conclusion that the history of nationalism in Australia was not one of thwarted Australianness, but rather of thwarted Britishness. Australians had two views of Britain and the Empire, which, while they overlapped, were quite distinct." I'm still quoting from Meaney. "One treated Britain as the metropolitan superior, the heart of the empire, and Australia as the colonial subordinate, a peripheral adjunct. The other saw the empire as a multipolar structure, an alliance of British peoples in which all white constituent elements were entitled to consideration and dignity. Australia, equally with Britain, the teleological nationalists considered the first view to belong to an Australian or Anglo-Australian imperialists, Bob Menzies being the arch-villain, and interpret the assertion of equality under the second as evidence of independent Australianness. Yet both are manifestations of an identification with Britishness. They only differ in how it should be expressed. This ambivalence arises from a situation in which the local settler claim and the metropolitan one can have equal status. Settler colonial forms challenge the hierarchical relationship between core and periphery that is inherent in colonial and imperial relations." I want to introduce a terminological distinction here. Settlers are not colonials. Now, we instinctively know that settlers are not indigenous people because they come from somewhere else. I already mentioned that settlers are not migrants, even if they do come, but both come from somewhere else, because they travel with a sovereign charge that the migrant don't have. They are founders of political orders. They go to their own country, they don't join someone else's. settlers are not colonials. Colonials have a hierarchical, or retain a hierarchical colonial understanding of the relationship between metropole and settler locale. Settlers, on the contrary, have an isopolitical imagination. There is also another distinction that separates a colonial from a settler. A settler is a bona fide settler, bona fide settler, someone who wants to stay, who is determined to stay, who has an, what in Latin is an animus manendi. A colonial is someone that wants to make money and go home. He has an animus returnandi. He could be a mala fide settler. An understanding of what isopolitical relations, how isopolitical relations work, can help in understanding the difference between what's a colonial and what's a settler. For example, Wakefield, the guy behind the colonization of New Zealand and South Australia, the systematic colonizer, espoused a colonial conception in his view of a view on the art of colonization, 1849. He noted that, speaking generally, colonies and colonists, he wasn't using the word settler, are in fact, as well as in the estimation of the British gentry, inferior, low, unworthy of much respect, properly disliked and despised by people of honour here, who happen to be acquainted with the state of society in the colonies. So he had a classical, sort of hierarchical sense of where the colony stands in relation to the metropole. So Wakefield envisaged a hierarchically integrated system with the colonizing metropole on top and the settler colonial locale as a subordinate element. However, he was convinced that the settler locales could be made to look very much like the metropole. In this sense, he proposed that their relationship with the colonizing could be only marginally subordinate. But the dynamic relationship between settler visions and colonial visions was actually shifting. And could be summarized in what James Bellich, New Zealand historian James Bellich, has recently focused, has recently defined as the settler revolution, a comprehensive shift in sensitivities from a colonial vision to a settler vision, from a hierarchical, sympolitical colonial vision to a to an isopolitical vision. Indeed, debates during the second half of the 19th century comprehensively reinterpreted the relationship between settler locale and colonizing cause. The settler locale was comprehensively redefined as a site for possible political redemption. Mill, for example, thought that the colonies, he meant the settler colonies, could be sites for unprecedented experimentation. In the previous case, well, in the case of colonial understandings, the settler locale is appropriate precisely because it resembles the metropole. In the latter, the settler locale is appropriate primarily because it is dissimilar from it. So we can actually sense the paradigmatic shift between a colonial understanding and a settler colonial understanding, the meaning of the settler revolution. And I argue that the imagination underpinning this relationship became isopolitical. The global settler revolution entailed a global isopolitical turn. Indeed, the American Revolution had terminated a sympolitical project and had defeated a centralizing metropolitan effort to ensure sustained metropolitan ascendancy. Therefore, as well as breaking up the first British Empire, the American Revolution can be seen as actually reconstituting a new one in an alternative form. In this sense, the independence of North America, of the North American colonies actually consolidated settlerism of political forms within the British Empire at large. Eliga Gould defines the Second British Empire as a non-unitary collection of polities, a consortium of realms and provinces, and links this diversity with the outcome of the American Revolution. Parliament never again attempted to tax in a direct manner the settlers of the empire. Its political ties could grow and consolidate within this context, both inside and outside the US. The American Revolution can thus be seen as an isopolitical moment in a consolidating and expanding settler colonial world. In a paper recommending the union of New British History and Atlantic History as an antidote against nationalist teleologies, against American particularism, and against Whiggish pieties of Anglo-British self-congratulations, David Armitage recently focused again on Greater Britain. Now, when I'm talking about these isopolities, I'm actually talking about Greater Britain. The sources I'm referring to were thinking about Greater Britain, except one who was talking specifically about isopolity. I'm getting to it. Armitage, in fact, was exploring yet another isopolitical moment. J.R. Seeley was explicit in favor of isopolitical relationships. The British Empire should do what the United States does so easily. And I'm quoting, that is, hold together in a federal union countries very remote from each other. Freud would argue in very similar terms. Seeley's expansion of England had an educational purpose. It aimed to describe an ethnological unity, that is, an isopolity, comprising the colonies of settlements, the Caribbean, but not India, because it had been conquered. Seeley popularized Greater Britain, but the term had originally been invented by Charles Dilke. Seeley at Cambridge, E.A. Freeman, a bit later at Oxford. This was a coherent effort aimed at rethinking the nature of empire. Freeman toured the United States in 1881, 1882, talking about a brethren in a higher brotherhood, born of one ancient stock, speaking one ancient tongue, sharers under different forms in one ancient freedom. Sharing under different forms one ancient freedom is a key trait of this type of discourse. It amounts to a description of isopolitical ties. Albert Van Deese, one of the founders of the London School of Economics, explicitly called in 1897 for the establishment of an isopolity, which he interpreted as common citizenship of the English race, uniting Britain and its settler dominions and the US. Indeed, isopolity was probably only explicitly mentioned this late in the debate by Dicey at the end of decades of sustained discussion, because elsewhere it went without saying. He specifically argued that an isopolity should be merely formalized in order to mirror an already existing one, a classic case of an imagined community of white men. He carefully excluded indigenous people from the working of its proposed isopolity. And he also suggested that an isopolitical move could be used against the migration to the US of a variety of undesirables. A reminder that settler colonial forms are equally exclusive of indigenous and exogenous others. While his proposal did not eventually meet with significant political support, what is remarkable is that in proposing for a union between Greater Britain and the United States, Dicey was actually taking for granted the isopolitical union of Britain and its settler colonies. However, the long-lasting resilience of isopolitical sensitivities and sensibilities as they apply to Greater Britain should be emphasized. Winston Churchill, for example, wrote an isopolitical history of the English-speaking people in 1956-1958. The empire was dissolving in the context of a model of decolonization that focused on sovereign Westphalian independence. The Commonwealth was reconstituted in ways that were now including colonized others and enlisting them for the Cold War effort. But the empire of racial identity was still showing a stubborn resilience. However, as I have argued elsewhere, isopolity retains a contemporary relevance, for example, in the relationship between the US and Israel in the Middle East. And I'm concluding this section and probably my bit. Recovering the isopolitical nature of settler colonial imaginings is also crucial because a focus on colonial subordination as opposed to independent national sovereignty can make settler colonialism disappear. I'm performing now a disappearing act. Canadian and US historiographies, for example, have formed around the issue of American independence. In the US, it was an accomplished sovereign independence. In Canada, counterpointedly, it was a sustained relationship and connection with Britain. In this case, a dialectical opposition between rupture and institutional continuity has contributed to blocking off settler colonialism in both countries. In the US, a focus on anti-colonial struggle traditionally prevented colonialism from entering the analytical field. In Canada, colonialism did not enter the analytical field because it was by definition something done by someone else. The historiographical revisions did not focus on settler colonialism either. In the US, the main argument was that even if it had been previously denied, U.S. foreign engagements were actually imperialist. That is, colonialism was brought into the analytical field, but not settler colonialism. In Canada, the argument was that the British imperialism was actually Canadian imperialism. That is, colonialism was overturned, but settler colonialism didn't enter the field. And so, in the case of these two settler nations, you have no possibility of actually talking about settler colonialism. And there's a lot of people that talk about colonialism, but my argument is that since colonialism and settler colonialism work differently, actually these people are backing up the wrong tree. Thanks for that, for the Australians. Now I move on to the second part of my paper, which is the most very underdeveloped, so it won't take long. Anthropologist Deborah Bird Rose talked about deep colonizing in a 1986 paper dealing with the position of Aboriginal women in the context of developments in land rights legislation and Indigenous tenure. An ostensibly progressive legislation endowed with a liberating charge, she argued, could also have an oppressive outcome. Aboriginal women, she argued, were being disempowered in the context of attempts to integrate Aboriginal policy and Aboriginal structures of government. However, decolonizing as an analytical tool could be pursued further and applied to all circumstances where a progressive decolonizing move for some ends up further compromising the position of others. Now, this intuition is actually John Kelly. In another context and reflecting on a completely different matter, she was thinking about the Renaissance. John Kelly has concluded that events that further the historical development of men, liberating them from natural, social, I've got 1 minute, or ideological constraints have quite different, even opposite effects on women. All of this to say, settler emancipation actually furthers the subject position of Indigenous people. That's counterintuitive. But I'm arguing that civil rights movements, by treating Indigenous people as colored and not Indigenous people, are actually an instance of deep colonizing. As Maria has argued in a great paper on Rudd's Apology, reconciliation can be seen as deep colonizing, and we can discuss this later. Finally, one last point I want to make. Thinking about isopolitical relations can be useful in thinking about what a post-settler situation could look like. If settler colonialism could operate isopolitically, perhaps a post-settler passage could introduce isopolitical relationships. We could envisage indigenous polities, indigenous entities operating isopolitically within liberal settler states. Thank you.